One of the most prolific and beloved children's authors from the 20th century, Thornton Burgess introduced themes of conservation and science through his stories of animals and the environment in which they lived. Christy Palmer-Lawrence has written a new biography of Thornton Burgess, Nature's Ambassador, The Legacy of Thornton Burgess, and she joins us in studio this morning. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So Thornton Burgess, a gifted storyteller, but he was also a conservationist, and his love for nature and the land stemmed from his childhood in Sandwich. What was his early life like growing up in Sandwich in the 1870s?
Good question. It was quite difficult, actually. His father died when he was 10 months old, and this thrust Thornton Burgess and his mother into an extremely difficult situation very early. He was born in 1874, and they had to rely completely on family for housing, to a significant extent on other for other things as well. She sold candy. But in his autobiography, he talks about his effort as a child to help support the two of them by picking mayflowers and blueberries and cranberries and anything that a child could do, shovel sidewalks when there was snow. But money was very much on his mind as a child, and he talks about earning enough to buy his clothes when he was 10 years old. So it was difficult. At the same time, he makes it very clear in throughout his life that his early appreciation of nature, his understanding, and I think the special camaraderie that he felt with wild creatures was fostered in Sandwich, much as a result of the need to be out trying to earn money in very simple ways.
Of course, a prolific writer. Not only did he write a syndicated newspaper column for almost 48 years, but he also wrote a number of children's books. And the irony is that for an author who was so beloved and prolific, he started out writing as a means to earn a living, not because he was passionate about it.
Exactly. Many people don't realize that he was a journalist and editor for Good Housekeeping magazine long before he began writing. His first book was Old Mother West Wind in 1910. But you're absolutely right. It was more or less accidental. He had written stories for his son. Interestingly enough, Beatrix Potter's books began in the same way as story letters. Excuse me. But Burgess wrote these stories for his little boy, who was away for about a month. And it was just to keep the relationship going, to be a comfort to his son, to continue something that he'd always done. And a little brown editor happened to be in the Phelps Publishing Building where he worked, and asked if, you know, there was anything of interest around, and Burgess's editor happened to mention that these stories, which he had run in Good Housekeeping magazine, were available. And so, you know, as I say in the book, it's every writer's dream to have this happen, you know. looks great, you know. Can you do more?
Since you mentioned Beatrix Potter, let's talk about the controversy over Peter Rabbit.
Well, that is who named Peter Rabbit, and the issue is that Thornton Burgess used that name. A lot of people have some confusion about the timing of that. Beatrix Potter self-published Peter Rabbit in 1901, and Burgess's Old Mother West Wind, using the name Peter Rabbit, came out in 1910. In the book, I have two people commenting on the two points of view. One, that this is a plagiaristic thing. It's unacceptable, would be today anyway. And the other, that in that day, which was really at the beginning of children's lit, when it was making a break from adult literature, in a more significant way. It was really being taken seriously, and children's librarians and others were really taking a very hard look at the quality and the caliber of children's lit. But I sort of picture this as literary mayhem to a degree, maybe an exaggeration. That the publishers were recognizing this merging interest in children's books, and writers were being encouraged to just pump out as much as possible. And the use of names, actually someone else used Burgess's Peter Rabbit characters' names a few years later. Mm-hmm. So this borrowing of names was something that wasn't completely uncommon. And David Mitchell, who's with New York University, has taught children's literature there for 30 years. I believe he's retired now. But he makes the point that Burgess's character was completely different in the habitat that he lived in. He was a wild rabbit and, yes, wore clothes and spoke, but in that he was very clearly part of an ecosystem, yeah. That his friends were other wild creatures, right. And all of them looking for food in nature.
And the point that, as you said, these began as stories to his son as Beatrice was creating her stories. Mm-hmm. And his son probably already this character of Peter the Rabbit was already familiar.
Well, that's exactly right. That's why he picked that name, because the rabbit is just a beloved literary character. Mm-hmm. And as Burgess says in his autobiography, there was only one rabbit
named. That was Peter Rabbit.
And that was Peter Rabbit. So he had no choice but to go with that.
So many of his outdoor observations in nature were used as plots for his stories. And he was gifted at packing ecological facts within fiction. Mm-hmm. Perhaps key to his popularity amongst children was the animal characters we're talking about. Jimmy Skunk, Sammy Jay, Bobby Raccoon. Talk about how he used these characters to introduce children to the natural world.
Well, first of all, he was a marvelous storyteller, and the effort to write for him seemed to require very little of him. He wrote very quickly, so the storytelling piece of it seemed to be, as I said, effortless. But what he put into his stories was as accurate in natural science fact as he could possibly make it. He read books constantly. He consulted scientific experts. If there was any question about whether a creature ate this or that, mm-hmm. he would consult an expert source to determine that.
Yeah.
And the scientists of his day recognized this. They appreciated the fact that there was scientific accuracy behind his stories. And I think one of the best examples, I came upon this fact that in 1931, there was a Matamec environmental conference in Labrador. By chance, he attended this with his friend Alfred Gross, who was giving a presentation. But this was an extraordinary conference. It was on biological cycles, the best minds, the scientific minds in Europe, in Germany, England, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. attended this conference. And Burgess makes a comment in his autobiography that he knew a few of the people, having consulted with them. But he said everyone seemed to know him. And he was just stunned, you know, at the recognition that he had.
We should mention his writing style. In the book, you write, Burgess likened his writing process to the act of unwinding a ball of twine. I begin with the title and unwind. There isn't any plot yet. That develops for me as I go along, just as it will go for the reader. When I start a story, I haven't any idea at all how it's going to end.
I know. It's a mystery. As a nonfiction writer, it's a mystery to me how he did that.
Exactly. But it's a talent.
it's just a talent. Yeah, and the rapidity with which he wrote, not all of them, I'm sure. He must have labored over some, and obviously honed his craft as he went along. But I make the point, and this was the fun of writing a biography, is really having to understand a person, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. completely. And I mention in this that as a journalist, he was writing for multiple publications. He had deadlines. He was desperately working, mm-hmm. you know, to get as much out as possible. He had just the fiercest of deadlines. And I think the rapidity with which he wrote children's stories, that was honed.
Yeah,
you know, he
exactly.
learned that.
Yeah, we have to talk about the illustrations. With any children's book, illustrations are another way to connect with the reader. Mm. And Harrison Caddy was one illustrator that brought to life the characters of these beloved animal characters. And you feature some of those in the book. Between the illustrations and some of the photographs in here, I think the book is worth it just for that. I mean, the story, of course,
you.
Is great, but you don't see this anymore. I mean, to this kind of quality.
Well, it's true. You're referring to Harrison Caddy.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people just, they do so connect with these. And they really bring a memory of the childhood reading of these.
Yeah, I think that's maybe why we're so connected. You know, because there's a lot of great illustrators out now, but I think it's that emotional that we go, oh, I remember these books when I was a kid.
Yeah, I read somewhere in the research that the imprint of childhood is very strong. It's maybe more lasting.
Yeah.
So what we came to love in childhood does. You know, sustain.
So for sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So he described himself as having many irons in the fire, and one of those was radio. It started out simply in the 1920s when he would read his syndicated newspaper column aloud. But by 1925, mm-hmm. he introduced the Radio Nature League. And this was one of the first radio programs to incorporate education into the radio medium. And it was a concerted effort to bring science into the daily lives of people. So tell us a little bit more about the Radio Nature League program.
This was an idea he had. It it kind of occurred to him in 1924. In the first week of 1925, he had his radio program going and had been on for a while. And he said to his listeners, look, I've got this idea. We'll have a Radio Nature League. You will pledge to support wildlife. He had a number of programs like this where it was a club thing. It was a membership thing. And to be a member, you had to pledge being a conservationist, mm-hmm. basically.
Yeah.
And so those values, I think this is part of the strength, the importance of Thornton Burgess, was that he was promoting these values. So he had he asked people to get in touch with him if they thought this was a good idea. Enough of them did. In the first week, he had over 2,500 people get in touch to be members. And there was an article in Christian Science Monitor within the first week, the first 3 weeks, he had 4,500 people. So the response was just really overwhelming. And I make the point in the book, you know, I had to think about this. Okay, is this just the phenomenal charisma of the man? Mm. Is there more to it? And the phenomenon of radio, the great appeal, almost not unlike the internet today,
mm-hmm.
The excitement of people realizing that they could have a voice, a person that they knew in their living room.
Yeah.
It was tremendously exciting. And for that, children and adults could take part. There was no distinction. So mm-hmm. this was Radio Nature League was begun for children, but he had probably half of his listeners were adults.
Yeah, because he had messages kind of weaved in for adults as well. We're talking with Christy Palmer-Lawrence. Her book is Nature's Ambassador, The Legacy of Thornton Burgess. Talking about his experience with radio, he had talked to many audiences, and anybody who's stood up in front of a crowd, you know, and you've got all that feedback, people looking at you, radio is a completely different thing. He's in this room by him, you know, self behind this microphone, a completely different experience. Mm. And at first he's, you know, doesn't know what, yeah, he says he wants to talk really loud and, you know, he does well. But you have a letter where he talks a little bit about the radio experience. You want to read some of that?
Right.
And tell us what this letter is.
This was, it was actually an article that he wrote for Popular Magazine. And I think what's delightful about this is Thornton Burgess talking about the audience. And he mentions excuse me, a friend of his who had no faith in the invisible audience. This man also had a radio program, and Burgess says he knows how he felt. But he says, from the platform, I have addressed many audiences, ranging from the intimacy of small groups to thousands. But never have I succeeded in establishing with these listeners the direct personal contact, the intimate relationship, which has been my experience with radio audiences. It has been a revelation in regard to the power of the spoken word. Today, I would rather talk to a radio audience than any other audience in the world. Why? Because it is the most human audience. And he goes on to say that he has the undivided attention of the audience. People aren't wondering why he parts his hair where he does or if his wife bought his tie. He says, quote, they care nothing about my gestures. I am merely a voice. Yet I'm also a neighbor. They do not leave their homes and go out to hear me. Instead, I come to them. I come to them at their fireside and join their family circle. I am a neighbor dropping in weekly for a friendly chat. So this was a man who... as he said, one time he says he's addressed an audience of 2,000 children, but he was a lecturer as well as an author, and he was very accustomed to speaking to audiences. But as you said, you know, this was tremendously daunting, and he felt like an idiot speaking in this this empty room in front of
a microphone,
just what I'm speaking in front of, the next day, he ran into somebody on a train who said, "Oh, you sounded great. We could hear you perfectly." And oh, you could, you know, you could hear the relief in his words.
But he's right; it's such an intimate medium. He hits it, you know, spot on what he says in that article. We should mention these. He had teamed up with Austin Hobart Clark, a scientist at the Smithsonian, and brought these scientist voices to the airwaves. So this was a collaboration with Austin Hobart Clark. You want to talk about that?
It was initially Austin Clark was a important curator at the Smithsonian, and he contacted Thornton Burgess because of his Nature program to be on his radio program in Washington, the Smithsonian's program, and had no idea that Burgess had his own program was very seasoned, and. The two of them, it was just the phrase I use in the book is the kindred spirits. I mean, these two both just were so excited about the potential of radio to bring natural science to the average person into the home, take it out of the realm of academia and the professional world and put it into the hands of an ordinary person. And I think Burgess's radio program was proof of the tremendous reception of the public to learn about nature, to embrace it. But Thornton Burgess would have children were sending him little corpses of bugs and, you know, live animals. Yeah. He was getting all sorts of questions and, you know, actual specimens. And if he didn't know what something was or couldn't answer a question, he would consult Austin Clark. Yeah. And Austin Clark, obviously, you know, extremely knowledgeable, answered them. If he couldn't, he consulted other national experts. So Burgess's radio audience was getting the top scientific minds. Right. They had access to them.
And since we're talking science, you've got to tell us about this letter from the, to the Albatross, from the Albatross.
Oh, yes. This is just delightful. I found this in the archive at the Burgess Society. And this is a letter from Harry R. Chatham, who was working on the U.S. Fisheries Research Vessel Albatross II. They were on George's Bank. And Chatham writes to him and says, "Enclosed is a moth in paper. Haven't the slightest idea what he is, but last night at about 10 p.m., a swarm came aboard. We are 180 miles southeast of Boston Lightship, quite a way out from Cape Cod. We passed through a cloud of them Wednesday night." But he simply thought Thornton Burgess would be interested and thought Thornton Burgess listeners would be interested. And so this from the Albatross, and He says, P.S., had a moth saved here to send you, but I guess he escaped. The whole crew, skipper and all, will testify to the swarm of moths aboard here. So he also got a letter from Ivan Bailey, who was a migratory bird warden in North Sydney, Nova Scotia, who wanted Thornton Burgess to ask his listeners if they would help subsidize the expense of a game warden for two islands in his area. That he describes the migratory birds that were up there and the inability of the government to pay for this. Mm. And he thought perhaps Thornton Burgess's listeners would help out. Mm. So an early radio appeal for
funding.
There
you go, right. And what's interesting is you also have some quotes throughout the book from Carol Chittenden, who's, you know, Eight Cousins Bookstore,
yes,
kids book, and talking about the popularity of his book still today.
Right. Carol was a marvelous interview. It was really great. She's, you know, has long
been... She knows her books.
She knows her books. She does indeed. And long been enthusiastic about Burgess. But one thing she said, I quote her, I thought it was so impressive. She was saying that today books last, you know, just scant years because of the publishing arena. Mm-hmm. And she said for a book, any book, to last 100 years is absolutely phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And half of books of Thornton Burgess's books are still in print.
Yeah.
So it's really quite remarkable.
Yeah, quite a testament to his talent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, just I'll mention briefly, we talked about his childhood and the difficulties. It was him and his mom. And then he marries Nina. Mm-hmm. And she dies after giving birth to their son. I mean,
right.
Sad. So he does get married again, but he did have some, you know, some tough times.
Oh, he absolutely did. It was not an idyllic life at all. And it was ironic that his son experienced the very early loss of a parent. He, mm-hmm. Thornton Burgess's son, who was named Thornton Burgess III, never met his mother, just mm-hmm. as Thornton Burgess never met his father.
Yeah.
So it was quite difficult, and the depth of Thornton Burgess's, he was obviously a very deep feeling man, and the depth of his loss, the grieving that he experienced was documented in in letters and journals.
So the Thornton Burgess Museum and Sandwich is closed to the public, but there are other ways for folks to connect with the Burgess legacy here on the Cape. The Thornton Burgess Society operates the Greenbrier Nature Center and Jam Kitchen at 6 Discovery Hill Road off of 6A and East Sandwich and the East Sandwich Game Farm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And let me add, too, that the museum is really more relocating to the Greenbrier facility on 6A and East Sandwich. There are plans for developing a museum room there.
That'd be great. All right. The book is Nature's Ambassador, The Legacy of Thornton W. Burgess, Christy Palmer-Lawrence. You know, we didn't get to a lot of this. We're going to have you back because there's so much more to talk about.
Oh, I'd love that.
It was really great to see you.